Hello, hello. Yeah. Okay, good morning. We are going to be looking at some web technologies and some web architectures today. But before we start, I would like to say that I have three members of the reference group. Thank you very much. My plan is that we'll meet most likely at the very beginning of next week, which means that we can discuss a little bit your experience from the first couple of weeks of lectures, the first assignment, but still with some time to make adjustments until we next Friday end the first kind of block of in the teaching. So if you have anything you would like to share in terms of experiences, in terms of what could make it easier for you. But not too easy, because to learn is requires some hard efforts as well. Then you can talk to me, the teaching assistants, or the members of the reference group, and then we'll see if you could need to make some adjustments for this year or maybe for next year. So what we'll be doing this week is to look at how to develop database systems. Now, it will be a focus on the platform that we chose. So there will be other types of database systems that will be standalone systems using different programming languages, using different types of databases, different environments. But what we hope here is that through the assignments and through the lectures, you get an understanding of the generic parts, what is typical. And I'm going to be pointing that out. What here is specific to our setup, and what is more general, something that you could use in any type of database system development. By the way, how many have started on the assignment already? Very good. It takes a bit of time to get through it. How many have started on the PHP part of it? Good. So it's slightly less than half. Now, what is going to be kind of the challenge here is that you have your assignment work, and we have lectures, and sometimes you start on your assignment, and the lecture is behind. Sometimes I lecture a little bit, something that we haven't been using before. So these are not going to be in sync. So sometimes in the lectures, I may talk about something that no of you have experience from already, and sometimes I will talk about something that you have been fighting quite a lot already. Which is, I think it's good, because as we said, I showed you the Kolb's model of learning. I think you need to get hands-on, you need to think about it, you need to get hands-on, you need to think about it. And when we talk about something up here, we may need to repeat it, and it's easy for you to understand what we talk about if you have that experience. But sometimes you need to know a little bit before you can move up. So this is going to be kind of climbing the ladder in a little bit of different speeds. Anyone, what is a database? We talked about it last week. What is a database? Anyone having a view on what a database is? So the answer from the audience was that the database is a server and a system. That's actually a database system. Database system is a server that has data and has people and routines. That is a database system. The database itself, when we talk about a database, we talk about a logical collection of data. So when we refer to the database, then if you remember, so here, what is a database here? Well, the database is these assignment one database, there's a book database, there's assignment five database. I have a database for the exam queries in 2016. This is the database that MySQL is using for its own data, the information schema, the dictionary. These are the databases. Collection of data that together makes sense. The database system is all of this. This is the, in this case, it's the Apache server, it's the PHP MyAdmin tool. So then we have the database system, and we have the database. Then the question is, what is the database management system? So, so that was the question for the database system, or the data to be in the database system. Does it need to be structured? Yes, there will be structures, and that is part of the responsibility of database management system, is to take data in whatever format we as programmers or as end user give it to the database system, and database management system will then decide how the best way to store this in files. And we talk about database files and structures and indexes at the very end of the course. But for now, if you remember, what DBMS are we using in our course? MariaDB, which is a type of MySQL. So when I say MySQL, I'm not totally wrong, because MySQL is kind of the family of databases, and MariaDB is the open source one. The MySQL brand name is owned by Oracle, so they have a custom-made one that you have to pay for. But the MariaDB is the free version of MySQL. So how do we see the DBMS here on this screen? We don't see it here. But the data we see, we got it by talking to the DBMS. First, we had to log in. So the database will not show us anything if we don't have the login criteria. In this case, it's phpMyAdmin that keeps the login information. What is the name of the database user? What's the password? And it's the database management system that decides which of these databases can I as a user see, because it controls access and privileges. When I get all this data up, it's the database management system that goes through its catalog to see what databases do I have. And if I go to the, let's see, the assignment one, and look at the book table, then whenever I interact here, it's the database management system that gets a query, says, okay, give me the tables of that database. Now when I click the data, the table, the phpMyAdmin goes to the database management system, or to MariaDB, and says, what are the rows in this table? And here are the data. So database management system is the service provider. When we want data, it's a service provider. It gives us data. So database is data. Database management system is our access to the data. The database system is the system that's using the data through the database management system. Is that okay way of keeping the concepts apart? Why do we want to use DBMS? What do you remember from our last week's talk about DBMSs? Yes, you can have simultaneous use. Multiple users can access the data at the same time without getting in each other's way or obstructing what the other one is doing. That's right. But it's also, we talked about data independence. You remember the file-based approach in which each department had its own files? Then the structure of the file would be specific to each department. So you couldn't combine data from various departments. They all had their own structures, and the structure was also in the program, which made the application program. For us, the advantage of having a database management system is that we don't have to worry about file structures. We don't have to worry about multiple users. We don't have to worry about privileges. There are services that we can use in the database management system for doing all that. We don't have to put it into our own source code, which means that our own source code can focus on getting the data, using the data, modifying the data, getting storing it back. So we can focus on the data use, not on how to make sure that it's managed in a very consistent way. I already talked a little bit about the system catalog that we also talk about as a dictionary. What is it? Yes, it holds the metadata. So it's actually, as I said, it's actually a database, a collection that are logically related data, but it's the data that the database management systems use for its own purpose. As you remember from those who were in the last lecture, so if you go to the information schema, you find these are tables, or actually they are views. We talk about, Dipti is going to talk about the view later on, but this is really the data that the database management system is using. So if you see here, we can find data about columns in tables. We can find indexes. We find whatever InnoDB uses. And we can find the system tables. So we have access to all the data. And this is important because if we want to make program or make data storage that is not dependent on the structure of our program, our software, then we need to store the structure so that anyone can understand what the structure is. In a relational database, everything is a table. And then what we need to know about tables is what is the header of the table, meaning what are all the columns or the attributes that we will call them, and what are the data types that you can expect for each of these columns. And then we have all the rows of data. So that's our view. And to understand what's in the various tables, then the system catalog is the database management system's own database of all the structural information it needs to understand, as you said, the metadata. Okay, so today we'll talk about web application architecture, and then we'll go into some web technologies later on. How many, I think I asked the question before, but I kind of forget. I think it was a small number. How many have programmed web type of applications before? Yeah, so around 20. So this would be probably a little bit of repetition and maybe something new as well. Why did we choose a web architecture for this course? This is a database course, it's not a web course. So why did I choose a web architecture anyway? So you have to go through and learn a little bit of HTML and HTTP and CSS and everything that's not really database. First of all, the advantage of using the stack that we are using is that it's platform independent. So you could install XAMPP on Linux, on Mac, or on Windows. So that is an advantage. Then we can all use our machines and environments, and we have a solution where not just the database, but also the client side, because it's all HTML. So we don't need specific client software for the various graphical user interfaces or graphical systems, for instance. And it is a pretty common architecture for database applications. You find that, you remember the list we had of all types of applications, and I had a bullet point just for internet applications, and these are all using the web technologies. Cloud services are all based on the web architecture as the lower level. And as you will see, I don't know, have you anyone tried to run some of the acceptance tests in the assignment one? Some of you? Acceptance testing can be difficult when you have a graphical user interface, because then you need to simulate that the user presses a button or enters some text and gets to see the result visually. Now, the good thing with our framework here, the web framework, is that everything is an HTML document, everything that gets to the user, and there's HTTP traffic. So it's easy to make the Codeception, and what other testing tools would do is they implement a tiny version of a browser. We'll talk about this next week when we talk about testing. make a tiny version of browser. They use some existing open source frameworks for developing browsers. So they have their tiny browser that simulates being a browser. So we can tell that browser simulator that we act as a user, and it will respond as it would to the user. So it makes acceptance testing easy, and for us that's good. That means that we can already have some hands-on experience of acceptance testing without having to learn a number of very hard tools to manage. And as we'll tomorrow and on Friday, I'm going to talk about PDO and programming database applications. You will see that the actual database programming is the same. What I'm going to do today and that stuff around us, okay, we need to learn it just for this course, and maybe it's useful for you later on as well. But what we learn about databases is very much the same. We're going to learn, and the way to access a database in PHP is very much the same as you would use in any other languages. Python or C++ or Java, it's the very similar. Of course, the signatures and the syntax is different, but the way we access and set up and get data is very much the same. There are some things we won't be covering that you will be covering if you were to do a data or web application development. And those of you who will continue next year into the course on web applications in the spring, I think Eivind is offering a course on developing web applications, then you will learn more about frameworks. Because as you will see, there's quite a lot of HTML and CSS and possibly also JavaScript code to write. And programmers don't do that from scratch. Programmers use frameworks. So even accessing the database, the way we're going to access database is not typically what you would do in a production house. If you produce software for database systems, you would typically use a framework, a server framework that would handle some of the low-level database access for you. So when we need to connect and set up and execute queries, all of that, in some of these frameworks, you just say, this is a persistent object. Give me the data, and then the framework will access the database. But now, at least by going through this course, you know what the frameworks are doing, so if you need to modify or extend the frameworks, you could do that. But we're not going to talk about frameworks on the server side, and definitely not on the client side. So on the client side, as you've probably seen, some of the web-based applications now are really like any graphical user interface application. You have all the nice features of drop and drag and drop and clicking and have updates of this various parts of the screen without going to the server every time. We're not going to talk about it, but if you were to develop web applications, frameworks would be important, and in Eivind's course, you will spend quite a lot of time on frameworks. So, what is this architecture? How does it look like? The client, in our case, it's the end user. We are sitting in front of our computers. What is the system that we use for accessing web data? All of us, every day.
Browser.
The browser. So this is our environment. The browser is the environment. Inside the browser, we have all this nice software, PHP, MyAdmin, or we have our banking systems or whatever. It runs inside the browser, and what's happening in the browser is the presentation and the user interaction. The server here will handle the data and the interaction between the client and the data. Some of this data is stored on the web server. So on the web server, we do have files and scripts. What kind of files we have on the server?
Images.
You will have images. So whenever there is a logo, whenever there is an image, you will have image files there. What else?
Web pages.
Web pages in forms of typically HTML. Some web pages are generated by scripts like PHP or ASP or some other scripting languages. And there are some CSS scripts for styling, We'll talk a little bit about CSS by the end of the day today. It's mainly used for setting up nice fonts and spacing and everything, but it can also be used to find content that we're going to be using. And there may also be some JavaScripts, and including JavaScript frameworks. So typically, when you access a web page, you'll see that there will be some .js files stored here on the server that will be sent to the client that actually runs on the client and that controls the user experience. In our case, since we are interested in database management systems and database applications and database systems, we also have the database server. So the web server will be talking to the database server. These may be on two very different computers. They may be far apart, or they may, as in my case, be in the same computer. I have a database server, the MariaDB server running. I have the Apache server running, and I have my browser running in one and the same machine. But ideally, what you're thinking about would be an architecture in which each of these tiers, so that's why we call them tier. This is tier one, the client tier. This is tier two, the application logic tier. And this is tier three, the data tier, where we store the database data. It's sometimes confusing because it's hard for, since everything is running on the same machine, it's sometimes difficult to say what's client data, what do I keep on my machine, and what is the server data. This is where I keep my source files. So if you can see up here, I have a project on the NTNU, I have on the bachelor courses, I have this course, and then I have the assignment one, and these are the same files that you have. These are the source files for the assignment one. They are here. This is my source directory. So this is on the client side. If you talk about the tiers, this is a client tier. It's mine. No one else can see that. But if I go here to I have installed the XAMPP server under the extras, XAMPP, htdocs. Under htdocs, so this is the root of my web server. I have the IMT2571, and here I have assignment one, and here I have an index.php file, which is a file here. So I have two versions of my source code. I have one here as a developer here at the client, and I have one here that the server would see. So when we want to run an application, we're going to run the files on the server. They are stored over here. So when I here go to my app, so you can see from the URL, I am at the... can you read it? Assignment 1, and IMT2171, assignment 1, and then index.php. So that is the URL on the local host, and it maps to the index.php file here. So this is on the server side. But then when I download it, and my Git repo is not here. My Git repo is on the client. Is this how you set it up as well? So if I go back to the... not here, let's see. So if I go back to the others, where I have my web server, and then under NTNU, Bachelor, IMT2571, I have the Git repo, or the data from the Git repo. Have you set it up that way, or have you stored everything under htdocs? You have everything under htdocs? It's generally not a good idea, because, I mean, in your case, it's okay, because whenever you're going to do this, you're going to test this. But think about what's under htdocs is the web server tier, which means that if you were running a production system, as you were modifying these files, you would literally screw up the service for anyone using your system. I'm going to show you some slides in a while showing how you should do this. Now, the PHP processor. Where does it fit into the picture? Well, it is a container. It's a piece of software that is an add-on to the web server. The web server is basically there to give you HTML files and give you image files. Whenever you ask for it, they will give you a file. Now, the Apache server, you can, when you set up the Apache server, you can register a PHP container, a PHP software, and then the PHP processor will run inside the web server. Or actually, the web server will start a PHP and communicate with the PHP browser, or sorry, PHP processor. So, when in my case, if you look at, and you've then probably looked at it already, so if you look at the, let's see, I didn't want to go there. So if you go to the XAMPP or to the web server and look at the PHP file, we see that the PHP file, if you already looked at it, it doesn't look very exciting. Because what does it do? Well, it asks for a file, PHP file being the controller of my application, and it's just creating a controller and it's invoking it. This is the PHP script. What is the result? Is this. And if you look at the view page source, let's do this. So this is the page source. What do I get? I get some script, I get some HTML, I get some CSS styling, I get some web page content. This is the body, it has the H1, there's a table, and there is a form for submission. So how did this happen? What happened is that here is a PHP script, so when I, as a user, type in the address for the PHP file, the web server says, hey, this is PHP. Okay, I'm just forwarding this to the PHP processor. The PHP processor executes what's there, and probably accessing other files, including the controller, including the model files, including the view files, generate a response, send the response to the web server so you can return it to the user. So that's the way the setup is, and that's the way it works. Now, then the question is, when is the PHP processor started? Because, as you could see, if I click on the file here, if I click on the file, I get in an editor. I get the source file. Now, if I take this, let's see if I can do this. I'll just squeeze this over. And this one a bit over the other way. So if I take the index.php file and open it in the browser, what do I get now? You have an idea? I take the file and I dump it into my browser. It does not run because it's a local file. So it's my local file, it's open in the browser, but it's a local file. So the PHP processor is not executed. Why not? If you look at this is where we need to think about the architecture again. So here, I have a browser here, I have my local file here, I put the local file onto the browser, what do I see? The file. To see it here, I need to actually go to the server. Did I go to the server? If you look at the here, is it the server name up here in the address? No, it's a file. It's a local file. So what I opened was a local file. What would the browser do with the local file? It's text, so it displays the text. For this to run, the file needs to be here on the server, and we need to access it on the server, which means that the address has to be the server address, not the local file address. So, we need to use the HTTP protocol. When we drag the file, what do we use? We use the file protocol, which means that HTTP is not involved. We're not talking to the server. We just took a local file that happened to be a PHP, and you just open it as any other file in the browser, and the browser knows how to open local files. And it needs to be a php.php. It was index.php. So if it's a file or if it's a URL to the, coming to the server using HTTP and it's a PHP file, then it will look for anything inside that and let the PHP processor replace what's there with whatever outcome of the processing will be. So that's why you need to copy files from your source directory to the htdocs directory. I just assume that quite a few of you created a local directory under htdocs for and went to the Git repo and got all the source files there, which means that in your case, the local development directory is the same as the web server file root doc root, which is a bad practice because if you had a running running application or a running web server, whatever changes you would do would be immediately affecting the end users. So if you made a programming mistake, all of a sudden your app wouldn't work. So rather create under where you whatever you if you have on your computer, if you have a directory for all your studies and you have a subdirectory for IMT 2571, create a subdirectory there for the assignments. That's your main working directory. That's where you make code, that's where you test code, and when it's ready for acceptance testing, when you're ready to see how it works in the browser, you copy it to the document root of your web server. So if you try to put PHP code inside HTML, it won't work. If we try to open the file in the browser directly, not through the server, it won't run because in that case it's just a text file. It happens to be PHP. Was that clear? Good. So now, what is the development workflow? And you, quite a few of you will be programmers. That's what's going to be your career in the end. Quite a few of you. So you will be one of these guys. But what you do here at school or at the university would mostly be as an individual. But keep in mind that what you do should also work if you were part of a team. So if you were a three-person team, that's why we use Git. And some of you are in teams, and you can see the advantage of sharing code through Git. Some of you are working by yourself. In that case, it's not so obvious why we should use Git. But Git is very convenient when you are a group and you develop and you need to share code. So here are programmers. And when we program local files. So you will all, each one of you will have your own version of the Git repo. You will modify your local files. What do you do then? When after you program, you obviously test. Or, as we'll talk about next week, maybe you make the tests first. And then when you program, you make sure that the code that you develop actually passes the tests. So this is the unit testing. You test your own code. You won't mess up for everybody else on the team. So you make sure that the things you develop, it works, that it passes the tests. And after it passes all the tests, then you could do an acceptance test. How do you do an acceptance test? You need to see that the application actually runs on the web server. Now the files are only here, so the first thing to do would be to, what do we need to do first? We need to copy it to the web server. They are currently here and we need them here. So the first thing is to do is to copy them. It's called deployment. It means that we deploy a new version of the system. It means copying whatever files we have modified. If we use Git, we could also have a Git server here, and deployment would be just to refresh and get the latest code from the Git server to the web server. That's one way of doing it. Or you use some other deployment tools. You copy the files. Whatever you do, you need to get the files that you have modified over here. And then you can do the acceptance testing. Acceptance testing means that the application as such works the way the user expected to. Unit testing that we did here was to make sure that all your files and all your methods, all your classes would do what they are expected to do, but there may still be problems in the communication between the various classes and the interaction with the controller and everything. It's a complex system, so it may still break. That's why we put it onto the server and we run acceptance testing. Acceptance testing means that we don't have to open the application. In my case, if I were to do manual testing, I would go here, I would see, okay, does it all come up? I would see what happens if I click this link. Something bad happened, okay, not good. I go back to my list. Something was screwed up. My app doesn't work. Okay, so even though the classes seem to work, there's something in the setup here that failed. So I have a problem. So I need to go through and understand. And the acceptance tests will tell you step by step what didn't happen, what didn't work. And now in this case, I'm quite sure that in this case, I'm not using the right version of the model class, which is the one that breaks. So the steps, and that's why I suggest that you, if you go back here, I suggest that you keep a copy, source copy. So if you have your if you have your file system, then someplace you have XAMPP, and someplace under there you have your HT docs. And this is whenever you write HTTP localhost, you get to see what's under there. So this directory here is whatever maps to HTTP localhost or 127.0.0.1. So when you type in this, and then we have, in my case, IMT 2571. I have assignment 1, index.php, and then there is an index.php here under htdocs, which is the one that's being served. So when I type in this address, then here under htdocs, I will then have, sorry, I would have an, let me, this was a little bit too quick. I have IMT 2571. And under there, I have my assignment 1. And under assignment 1, I have my index.php. So this directory matches this one. This directory matches this one. And this file is the one that's asked for over here. So that's how your local file system hierarchy maps here. But what I suggest is in addition, so somewhere you have, let's say, studies. Under studies, you have IMT 2571. Under there, you have assignment 1. And under there, you have your source files. These source files, or the assignment 1, is what you copy here when you deploy. Then you take whatever local files that you have implemented, you have tested, they work fine, and you would like to see if the application works fine. So you copy these files to the XAMPP htdocs and this proper subdirectory here. When they are put here, you can go to your browser and test manually. Or you can run the acceptance tests that we some of them you have already, and some of them you need to develop yourself. To get into the habit of not having, every time you do a change, not having to go through, load up the app, and click all the links and try everything. You leave that to the script. You write the script, and every time you make a change, the script will test that things work for you. We'll talk about this again next week. So keep two copies. One here, where you develop. When you've done all the unit testing, you deploy it on the server, and then you test it on the server. Question? This whiteboard?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Okay. then I do have an alternative. I'll do that one later on. Should I redo it already? Let me just, for those who are just watching the stream, let me just go back to my browser here. So in my case, I keep the source files here. No, not here. I keep my source files in under users, bachelor, IMT2531. So this is my source file directory. This is where I have all the Git files. And you can see this is where I have assignment one. This is the one that was the whole file that was downloaded. And I could copy the... So here I can see the source files that we have. And you can see I even run the composer. So I have the vendor files. And there you see the codeception. So this is my local development directory. When I'm done writing my scripts and writing my tests, unit tests, and testing that all my PHP scripts passes all the tests nicely, no errors, no warnings, nothing, then I can copy the files here into where the web server find it, which is under htdocs, which is the root directory for my web server. So whenever I, in my web server, type in localhost up here, then localhost and IMT2571 assignment one would be here. Under htdocs, IMT2571 assignment one, index one, that's the file that generates this, which is not my source file, because my source file is back in my in my source file directory, which is a different place. So I keep my files, if you go back to this one, I keep my files, source code files, on my own computer as I develop. I run my unit tests to make sure that my software is not breaking anyone else, because you're going to get used to this. When somebody on your team develops something, and they make a change that would make your code break, and they test their code, and they upload it to the server, and then when you try your code, it's broken. Not because you did anything, but because some other did something. To avoid this, you all have tests. You test first that your unit works, you upload it to the server, and you test that your code works nicely with everybody else's code, so that you didn't break any of the other developers' code. And when it's passing all of this, then you check it in to Git. Then others can get the latest versions and merge them with whatever they're doing, and you haven't broken any of their code. Okay, so I think that means that we make a break here, and then we're going to dive into some of the web technologies after the break. I hope this is clarifying in terms of understanding all the components we're working on and how you should set this up to make it easy for you to work, and how the development process that we are aiming at, how it is set up. And if you get into good habit now, then this is something that you can use in later courses, and when you are out in industry, are already working in the way that industry is expecting. Okay, 50 minutes break. Okay. I had a question during the break as to how you were expected to go through that, because there are a number of technologies here, HTML, PHP, PDO, Codeception, and in the assignment there is a big bulk at the very beginning, go through all these tutorials, learn all this stuff, and then there is a big list of tasks to do in the development. So the question is, how should you do this? Should you work and go through all the tutorials and try to learn everything about PHP, PDO from the tutorials and then apply it later on, or what should the process be? And what I suggest, I mean, this depends on what works best for you, of course, but what I would think would work quite well is that you go through the tutorials quite briefly in the first round, so that you understand what is all this, what is PDO, how is in general, what are the features of PDO, how can we see that you can use PDO to connect to the database, you can use PDO to put a query to the database, you could use PDO to iterate over data from the database, you could use PDO to get to what was the assigned ID, so you get an understanding of what PDO can be used for, but not trying to remember everything. Just work through it and see that you understand the steps and you can get a general understanding. Then, when you come to the later part here, it's about developing all the code. Then you need to do it right. So when you are, so I don't know if you all understand the setup here, but if you look at the code, you need to understand my structure, and it's a model view controller structure. That's why the model view controller data is there. You need to understand what is the model view controller architecture. And so if you go to the source, you need to understand that the controller is the one that controls everything. Views is whatever sets up the HTML response, and the model is the interaction with the database. So this is where you need to go. And your tasks will be, part one is to implement the functions in DB model. If you look at DB model, it's supposed to do the same thing as model. It's just going to use the database instead. And we'll talk about this a little bit further into this lecture. And then, so you just need to implement the same functions that are already here in the model. These are the same functions because they inherit the abstract model, and the abstract model tells us what the model is supposed to do. One implementation is storing it on the web server. The implementation you're going to make is storing it on the database, which means that you need to implement. Here is a constructor that is setting up the default database. In the DB model, you need to connect to the database. So here it says create PDO connection. So now you need to go to the tutorial or to the PDO reference literature or to my lecture slides from tomorrow or Friday and figure out how do I connect to the database. And that's what you're supposed to do here. You put in the statements that are needed to connect to the database. And then the next thing is you're supposed to implement the get book list. The current implementation is just returning an empty list. You should go to the database, find the book list, and return a page with all the books. So this is what you need to implement. And what I would come back to this next week, what I suggest as the way of working is that before writing the code, you write the unit test for it. You go through the existing application and try to understand what is this function supposed to do, and then you write what are the characteristics of a successful operation? What do I see on the page if this was successful? What information is on the page? And then what has happened to the model object because of unit testing? So what should the model object look like? What changes should we see in the database after? Or what should we get from the database? And what should we see in the database? And then you write a test first. When we have the test, then we can write the code. And then when we want to test, we run the test on the code. And if the code doesn't pass, it might be of two reasons. Either we didn't implement it correctly, or our test was not correctly implemented. This is the frustrating part, because sometimes when the test fails, we think that the problem is in the code, but maybe the code was right, maybe the test was wrong. So over time, we need to spend time to improve on the tests, but gradually the tests get to be error-free, and then we know that if you find the bug, it will be in the code. We'll come back to this next week, but just so you have an understanding of what's going to happen. And as I was writing, and unfortunately no one is seeing what I write on this board, so I can use the one over here later on. But think about this. We will be going a little bit different speeds. You work on your assignment, and then we're going to cover some of these topics in the lecture. Sometimes you do it before the lecture, and sometimes after. And that's how it's going to be. Now, web technologies and development tools. Because one thing I hope that you get out of this this course, besides programming PHP and also knowing a little bit about web applications, is that when we develop, we surround ourselves with good tools so that we get help to understand what you're doing and see what's happening. Testing framework is one set of tools. Now what we're going to be using here will be the development tools that comes with the browser. And in the browsers, you have development tools. And now we're going to see how we could use them to understand what's going on and to for experimenting and understanding. And also, when we have a problem, we can use these tools to go through and find what the issues are. There are many technologies. And the ones we are going to be talking about now would be the URL and HTTP first. Well, they are part of that, what I call the alphabet soup. So besides the URL, HTTP, HTML, and CSS selectors, we have JS for JavaScript. We have AJAX for making interactive applications. It means asynchronous JavaScript and XML. We have REST. Some of you have probably heard about REST, which is a way of making web-based APIs or interfaces to software. So there are a number of abbreviations that you may encounter. We'll talk about the four up here, because these are the ones that are going to be useful for the assignment. And really the purpose of the assignment is to learn to program database applications. So, URLs. You are familiar with URLs, aren't you? You hope so. So URLs are, what are these? Well, they are addresses. These are addresses to pieces of information or to some software that would generate some information. So the first part is the scheme, and we already saw HTTP, and we saw file. I mean, if we drop the local file onto the browser, we have a file scheme. We may also have a mail to. And so how would that look like? So if I here, if I do mail to and write someone, NTNU, N-O, NTNT, I'm not going to send it anyway, so that's fine. And then I just say subject, click hi, and body, click hi. What's happening if I try this one? It depends a little bit of your browser setup, but typically what's happening is that you get your mail client. And the address is put in here, the subject is here, whatever I typed in as the body is here. So it's a URL that ends up in my email client. So now I can, so whenever on the page, if I would like someone to mail me, I can already say, okay, put in my address and what the subject heading should be, and then it comes like this into the on the client side, into the end user. By the way, we'll talk about this later on in the course, and that ideally, we shouldn't use HTTP as much. We should use HTTPS, the secure version, to make sure that no one can trap what we communicate and look at what we have. If they get access to the communication, then they can see what we are sending. If you use HTTPS, it's encrypted, and then we don't have to worry about any problems with that. In addition, then we have the domain, which in our case may be localhost or ntnu.no or someplace where we have the server. We may have a special port. Ports are, in communication, each computer have a number of ports it can communicate, and one port can be used by one software. So the different ports are being used for different purposes. So you will see that MariaDB is using one port for database communication. The web server is typically using port 80 for communication, but if you can't use port 80, then you could set up your web server to run on 8080 or 8000 or something else. You will find that your mail server communication is through a different port. So sometimes you need to specify the port, but for the most used protocols and applications, you don't need to, because if nothing else, the web server will run on port 80. So you don't have to specify port 80. You may, but you don't have to. It will default to port 80 for HTTP. For other protocols or for other services, other protocols will be the default ones. Then we have the actual path. And as you saw, in my case, or in the case of the Mail2, we can have a query string. After a question mark, we can have a query string, and we can have multiple parts of the query with an ampersand in between the various parts. And we have the name of the what we look for and the value that we look for. In the end, we may have a fragment ID, which means that, and if I if I'm good at doing this, then I should use fragments, or I will continue using fragments on the Blackboard. So if you go to Blackboard and look at lectures, I have a link up here that says go to current week. So if I click that one, you see down here, we are now at week 35. So it will go then directly to week 35. And when I click it, week 35 will come on top. Unfortunately, you don't see the heading because of this line here. So in my case, you will see the heading as well. But in this case, it's underneath the overlay there. So these are the fragments. So we can go directly to certain nodes in an HTML document. So that's how the URL is set up. And for our purpose, we usually use localhost. And we then the path is going to be that directory string that is, or the sequence of directories that are under htdocs. So if under htdocs we have an IMT 2571, and under there we have an assignment one, then this will be localhost, and then IMT 2571, and then we will have the assignment one, and then the name of the file. HTTP is a request-response communication. What does it mean? It means that the server doesn't do anything until it gets a request. So it waits, and then when it gets a request, it will respond, and it returns the result, and it forgets all about it. So it only acts at that one request. We have two types. We have more types of requests, but in our case, we worry about two. One is to get data, and one is to post data. Get means that we want to go to the server, and we pass some query strings for what we look for, and we want that information back. Post means that we want to update what's on the server. We want to make changes to what's on the server, add something new, or modify something. And then we use post. And then there are a number of headers that will be passed without us knowing. And one would say, the browser would say, what type of data it will accept. Cookies, you heard about cookies? I think nowadays you have to worry about cookies, because you always got the questions, oh, do you want the cookie stored? We do keep cookies. A cookie, what is it? Well, it's really just a piece of data that is stored on your computer. So the server passes you some cookies that are data stored on your server, And the next time you connect to the same server, it would send all the cookie data back up again. Why do we need this? Because the server doesn't remember anything about talking to you before. The server deliberately ignores. It doesn't know, when it gets a request, it doesn't know anything about the request. It just answers. So if you need the server to remember something, then you need to pass the information to the server. The question? They will look for the cookie, absolutely. Yeah. So if there's no cookie, then they may set some values, and if they find a cookie, and cookies can have expiry dates, and there are much more to cookies. I'm mentioning it because we're going to understand the model that I implemented, the one that's there already. You need to understand cookies, because you need to understand sessions. And it will say, it will give the host, which is basically the address of the server, and the user agent that would say what type of browser are you using, what's your client. So there's quite a lot of information being sent in headers. And then, depending on what is the outcome on the server, you would typically get 200 OK. So anything starting with a 2, there's a 3-digit response, and anything starting with a 2 is OK. There may be some other successes as well. There may be a redirection, which means that it didn't fail, but the content has moved, so it will give you a new address that you should go to instead to find the content. 4 means that there's something wrong on the client side. You ask for something that is not there anymore, so they consider that to be a client problem. So if it was some information that was deleted, that's not a server problem, that's a client problem. So that's a client error, not found. There may be other errors as well. And the 500 series is for server errors. So if the server crashes or it is something on the server side that you can't blame the client, then there will be a server error. And the headers here will be a location where you should reroute to in the case of redirection. It's the cookie. It will tell what is the content type, what is the information that you get back, so that the client can make some intelligent action on the various types of content. So, how do we do this if you want to track? So if we go to, this is similar in different browsers as well, but I'm using Chrome, so at least you get to see how it's in Chrome. So if I go to Chrome, then I can go to More Tools, Developer Tools. The developer tools are quite useful. They can be used for various things, And here we can go to network. And now I need to, I don't think, let's go here. Unfortunately, this one broke though. So I don't remember exactly what I did that made it break. That was wrong. Developer tools. Now, in the network, so if I refresh this page, then here it will say that there was some communication, and let's see, CSS, we will go to see all, and if you see down here, there is an index.php being requested. Do you see this line? Index.php being requested. The status was 200. The type was a document. So if I click on it, let me see if I can. This was very cramped. Can I make this larger? Okay, so this was. Let me just make it a bit smaller. Can I do that? Is it still readable? Yeah. So you can see what is the general. What was requested? This is the URL. What was the method? It was get. What was the result? 200. What was the remote address? It was port 80 on the local machine. No referer. What was the response headers? Cache control, connection, date, but more interesting. In the request header, we see there's a cookie. It's a PHP session cookie. And the PHP session cookie is being used to pass to the server so that the server can look up anything on, stored on the server side related to the communication. You don't, so this is a typical way of doing it. Rather than storing a lot of data in cookies on the client side, you keep it on the server side. And what you pass would then be the session ID in a cookie. So next time a user connects to the server, it will pass the cookie, and the cookie can be used then on the server side to pick up whatever information that the server would like to keep related to the communication here. Was this clear? So we can use this tool, the developer tool, in the network mode to see what's on the page. And unfortunately, it crashed. So if I do add new book, I get to the error page. Let me see if I can. It was a bit. Where do I see my requests? There you go. So if you look at the second one, you can see this is a post. These guys are posting something. 200 was okay, even though the web server was okay. Obviously, there was an error page, so obviously I didn't process correctly, so something was differently. But from a HTTP point of view, it was successful. Now, if you look at what the header for the request passed, in addition to the host and the session and everything, it has form data. So it passed some data to the server, and the form was one variable or one parameter was an op. It says add. There is no title passed, there is no author passed, and there is no description passed. So something is being passed here. So when I clicked on, if I go back to the previous page, if I clicked on the add new book here, it did send the form. That was saying I was doing an add operation. The title, the author, and the description was passed here. And if I look at the page source, we can find here at the very bottom that I have new titles, and there is a form called add form. You see that the input name op has a value of add. So that was the one that was passed to the server, so that the server knows what was the operation the user was requesting. Is this confusing? Use the tools, step through, and see what is happening as you click on the various links. If you click the link to a book, if you click on the submit, try to see what's happening. Because on the server side, when you develop PHP scripts, that's what the server gets. Would be whatever is passed in the post, whatever are the session objects. Those are the data that you have on the server side when you program a script, a server side script. So you can look at the type of information here as well, but we just did it in real time. What I clicked to get I was a bit quick on what I clicked here, if you remember, to get to see all the information was, let me see here, was to say preserve log. If I didn't preserve log, it was harder to go back. I couldn't see the previous call. So I didn't see all the calls before that, but now with the preserve log, it is possible to see them all. And then I can go and see these are the various. So the first index was the last one's a post. There was a post. There was a get in the beginning. and then I tested some posts. So you can go back in history and see the various calls, what's being passed, and this is how information comes to the clients. If you wonder why you don't get something when you write a script, it might be the idea to open the tool and see what was actually sent from your form to the client. So as I said, this is one of the development tools that are available, and that you, by getting familiar with these type of tools, you have a whole toolbox for testing and understanding and testing and working with this kind of software. We did already talk about this. So HTTP is stateless. And what does it mean is, as I said, when you get a request, then nothing is remembered on the server from before. Every request is independent from previous requests. And that makes making the protocol easy. That makes making the server easy. But it makes it hard. So, for instance, if you go to your bank, you log in, and after that, you browse your account, and you transfer some money, and each of these need to know who you are, but you log in only once. So how could that be? Again, this is the same mechanism that we just saw. You generate a cookie that has some session data, and you send it so when you log on, it's a bit more complicated in the logon case because you want to be very sure that no one else can take the cookie and mess up it. So it's a bit of a more advanced scheme, but the basics is the same. You pass information to the client that verifies that you were successfully logged on, and some information that the server can use to find who you are. So next time you go back to the server, the server gets that cookie, and it looks up and says, okay, hey, you are this guy, and you logged on, and this is your account, and then we can continue working. The same thing if you go to a store to buy stuff. I mean, if you go to buy some sports gear or some computer stuff, and then you go in one place, you add it to the cart, and you add something else to the cart, and remove something from the cart. I mean, building up, and in the end, you do a checkout. And then you have the whole cart, shopping cart, that you'll be filling up. And the way for the application to remember this is to keep a session. And in the session, you store information about your shopping cart. What did you shop? How many? And what information? Who are you? And what credit cards have you already registered? So, typical is to pass it in a cookie. Now, sometimes, if you don't want cookies stored on your machine, what can you do then? So sometimes they use what they call URL rewrite. Because in the URL, you have the query string, you remember? So first you have the scheme and the host, and then the whatever you're looking for, you have the question mark, and then you have the query string. So you can pass the session ID in the query string as well. So if the user doesn't want to store a cookie, then you can make sure that all the links that the user follows, all the addresses it follows, will have a query string that has a session ID there. So it is possible, even if the user don't want the cookies. But the question is, the thing is that you need to pass this information so that the user will pass it along again. And the easiest is to use a cookie, but you could also make sure that all the URLs, all the links the user can click will have the session ID in the query string. Because then you need to pass it back. Then what's happening then on the server? Well, on the server, then you have the session ID. You get it from the client, and you can use that to know who the user is. So it is possible, and that's if you look at the DB model. That's what I do in the model file. So let's see here. So if you go to the model file, oh, I already opened it properly. Is this readable, or should I make a larger font? So what I do here is, you can see the first time I come here, I see is there a session object called booklist. Is booklist, or is there an index in the session, which is an associative array? We're going to talk about associative arrays tomorrow. But the associative array is an array where the index is a text string. It's a kind of a lookup table. And what you look up here will be the name of the data that you want. In this case, it's the book list. And if there is no book list, I'm going to create one. This is the default book list. So whenever you start the model, there will be a book list. And in the book list, I create an array of three books that are in the book list. And in the book list, I also keep, or in the session object, I also keep the ID of the next book to be created. So if I create a book, I'm going to use this ID, and I'm going to increment it so that I know which is the next ID to use for a new book. So I'm guaranteed this is what the database is going to do. We talk about it with PDO. The database is doing the same thing. And the get book list is a very straightforward function. I just return the book list. So this, what this does is it goes to the session array to find the book list, and the book list is an array of books. And just returning that. What is the get book by ID doing? Well, it is trying to find a book with that ID, and if it finds it, it returns the book. Otherwise, it returns null. And how do we find the book? Well, it will go to the book list at that index where the book is. So try to familiarize yourself with the model, what it does. And the current model stores everything in the session object on the server, which means that whenever the server the session expires, or if the server crashes, it's all gone. The book list is gone. That's why we want a database. We would like to store it in a database instead in session memory. So what you're going to do is then to implement all these functions, but rather than storing it in the session object, you need to get the book list from the database. You need to get information about one specific book from the database. You need to be able to add information about the book in the database. So all these functions, you replace changing the session object with code that will store and get data from the database. That's your task. That's how, even though there's much of HTML and much other stuff in this assignment, it's mostly about the database part. So what you're going to program is the database functionality and testing of that functionality. That's your basic task. And if you look at it, the session object is a kind of a NoSQL database. It's what's called a key value store. A key value store is a database where you have lots of keys, and for all the keys, you get some objects, some values. And the database will basically just give me a key, I'll get you your object. So on your browsers, if you need a database in your application on the browser, then you could use some very trivial key value stores for just storing objects with certain keys. But we'll talk more about that later on in the course. Yes, so as I said, there are some session objects that is the current implementation. HTML. How many have written HTML? Okay, yeah, so this is more familiar. Let's just point out some of the parts that are relevant for the assignment one and for typically when we write code, and especially when we write acceptance tests on HTML applications. So I always like all documents to have a header where you have a title and everything else in the body. So all documents should have HTML with a head and title and a body. And inside the body, it's all nicely structured in headers and paragraphs and tables and whatever, forms. And as you know and as you see, then a document, an HTML document, is a hierarchy of elements. So here, every element has a parent. There's one exception. Which element doesn't have a parent? Well, actually, HTML does have a parent, and the parent is the DOM model that the browser has. So, but we'll talk about when it comes to XML. So outside of this, this one is connected to the browser's internal structure, and there is a header. But eventually, on top of the browser DOM, there is nothing. So the topmost doesn't have any parents. Everybody else has exactly one parent. That's what makes it a tree. Frode is going to talk about trees if you're not already into trees in algorithm methods. So this is a tree. So everything has a parent. And you can have zero, one, or more children. So in this case, HTML, how many children does HTML have? Two. It has a head and it has a body. That's right. And the title has one child, which is this text in here, and that text never has children. Texts are the leaf nodes. And this, you're familiar with the character entities? So for special characters, HTML has defined a number of character entities that you could use. So instead of having, if you like a long dash, you can use the dash that's as long as an M, or you can use an M dash that's a bit longer. So there are some characters. You can have copyright characters and special characters. So the most important part is here. We have a table. The table has a table head that I excluded. This is what's generated in assignment one. So if you look at the HTML code, it has a table, and it has a body, and the body has rows for each of the books. And each row has cells. So this is the first cell, the second cell, and the third cell. These cells are children of this row. This row is children of body, which is a child of the table. And then we have attributes. What's important about attributes is that we can have only one attribute once for an element. So we can't have repeated, can't have two hrefs in here, for instance. And the values will have to be in quotes. We can use single or double quotes. It doesn't matter which one you use, as long as you use the same at the beginning as we use at the end. So here I have single quotes, here I have double quotes. There's no basic difference there. When you come to PHP, there is a difference, and we'll talk about that in a short while, which means tomorrow. And attributes are kind of useful in this case. This is when you, I don't know how familiar you are with the anchors, but in the anchor here, if you click on the one here, then there will be loading up the index page with ID 1 as the search string. That's how we get book information about that ID or about that book. Then the ID attribute. Who has used ID attributes before? Not so many. Yeah, some. The ID attribute is quite useful when for testing. So as you can see, I have added quite a few IDs into the document generated in the assignment because that makes acceptance testing easy. Because then I can look up, is there an element with this ID? And does it contain what it should contain? That's how I can test that the web page that is returned is the type, does have the content that I'm expecting. So in this case, I have one ID for each of the books, so each of the rows of information in the table. I have an ID, book one, book two, book three, and then I can find the various books. Which is different. Some of you have been using HTML names as well, so in forms you use names. So why both names and IDs? Because, I mean, a name can also act as an ID. On the server, for instance, when the user fills in a form, then the name of the field would come with the value. So then you get the name of the field. So why then do you need ID in addition? One of the reasons for ID is that you have an answer? Yeah, in this case, it you can encode it more efficiently. Absolutely, you can have a number instead of a complete string. But the other thing with ID is that it's unique in the document. So for the names don't have to be in forms, for instance. They don't have to be unique because if you have two different forms on the page, you can use the same name in two different places. So for testing, that is inconvenient. If you have two names that are, or there are two values for the same name, then you don't know which one you're testing, or it makes it more hard to test it. But if you have an ID, then you know there's only one. because IDs are unique in the whole document. So you know that you have only one. So for testing, it's quite and for formatting, if you would like to format each one differently, then it's convenient to use an ID. So hyperlinks are kind of foreign keys. Dipti is going to talk about data modeling and is it over? I don't think so. not on my clock. Maybe there's a 2-hour limit here, and I came too early. like that. Am I running over time? No?
No.
Okay. So this is kind of a foreign key, which means that there is a reference to something else. And in databases, that's important. Sometimes you link data together. And as we were saying, one of the features of a database management system is to maintain integrity, among other things, referential integrity. So meaning that whenever there is a link like this, we are always sure that this book exists, which is not always easy to do on a web page. Forms. You're going to see a form being used. And among other things, we need to say whether the data is going to be posted or we just do a get. In this case, we like the form data to be stored in the database, which means that we should use post. And then we have the various input. We have the operation that is just saying that this is something we like to add. And then the name, title, there will be some text, and for author there will be some text, and for description there will be some text. And default value is nothing. That's what's sent to a server. And then the user will enter something for all these text, for all these input fields, and then will press the submit button, and then the data will go to the database and or to the server. And as we saw here on the if you look at the post, we see that the form has an add up. There is no title, there is no author, there is no description. Differences between get and post is if you keep the practice of making sure that you only use get when you get data. So if you want the server to store anything or make any changes, you don't use get. You always use post. Then you are usually quite okay. The only case where you may still need to use a post is if you have a very long query string to send to the server for information you want. Because if it's very long, typically more than 2,000 characters, HTTP may not send all of it, or the web server may not get all of it to pass it to the app. So if you have very long strings, then posts are safer. But usually, use get whenever you retrieve data from the server, and post whenever you store it there. Yeah. And to investigate HTML code, you use the same tool. We've been looking at those tools before. So if you go here, then you can look at the elements, and then we see the HTML code. We see here, it has some form with names and whatever, and we can review the code or the actual HTML. CSS selectors. Just very briefly about them in 1 minute. CSS selectors is a kind of a query language for hierarchical documents. We will talk about XPath later on in this course, but CSS serves a little bit the same purpose, different syntax, and Codeception supports both XPath and CSS selectors. And I think it's easy for you now to do selectors, and then we have the XPath and go through all of XPath later on in the course, but you could use that as well. It's mainly used for spacing, but we can use it to find given nodes. So we can do this again tomorrow, but just show you we can find all elements of a certain name. We can find the element with that certain ID by using a hashtag in front of it. We can look in subtree, which means that this will be all elements within the book list element, as a child or as a grandchild or some sibling, some under that book list. We can look for only the TDs that are within the body of a book list by using greater than. Greater than means that this needs to be a child, this needs to be a child, this needs to be a child. In this case, it's somewhere, we don't care, it's somewhere underneath. And we have what's called a pseudo class, which means that we can see whether this is the first TR or whether this is the second child among the TD children. So we can go through and play with them. We have some lecture tomorrow afternoon, so we can start by playing, and then we go into PHP after that. Okay, thank you. Hello.
Hallo. Opptak, det går.
Praksis om at studenter skal slippe å snakke i mikrofon, fordi de skal vite at de blir tatt på, og det en sånn der prøvlig policy på det.
Ja.
Så jeg gjentar spørsmålet, prøver å gjenta spørsmålet.
Okay.
Men det finnes jo en sånn der catchbox her, og det...